Coming up on Star Stuff, have scientists discovered a new comet in the inner solar system? Astronomers watch as the sun is torn apart by a black hole, and emotions running high as the last ever space shuttle flight is readied for launch. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Scientists using a recycled spacecraft have taken their first close-up look at an unusual hyperactive comet. The comet is 2003 P. Hartley 2. It's smaller but far more active than any of the other four comets studied up close so far. It's providing scientists with a new insight into these primordial celestial bodies left over from the formation of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. Scientists, including Professor Michael O'Hearn from the University of Maryland, used NASA's Deep Impact Mission spacecraft to study the comet, finding its small, unusually active peanut-shaped nucleus spewing out massive amounts of water vapor and ice chunks. Back on the 4th of July 2005, Deep Impact fired a projectile into the comet 9P Tempel 1 in order to study differences between the comet's surface and interior. Although the impactor was destroyed, the flyby spacecraft remained healthy and was reprogrammed into the EPOXY mission, EPOXY standing for Extrasolar Planet Observation and Deep Impact Extended Investigation. The spacecraft was then redirected to conduct a close flyby of the comet Hartley 2. On the 4th of November 2010, EPOXY flew within 694 kilometres of the comet's icy surface. The close encounter was just a week after perihelion, the closest point to the Sun in Hartley 2's six-year orbit through the solar system. Reporting in the journal Science, Ahern and colleagues say Hartley 2 is producing far more water than should be possible from such a small surface area. They say it seems to be happening as carbon dioxide and other volatile gases evaporate, dragging chunks of ice out of the nucleus. That's different from the other four comets studied up close so far. They're all releasing water when ice on their surface turns to gas as they get closer to the sun on their orbits from the outer reaches of the solar system. Hartley 2 has a peanut-looking nucleus with a narrow saddle-shaped waist between the two lobes. It's a structure which has been seen before on space rocks, but never as smooth as this one. Ahern and colleagues say most of the comet's degassing water seems to be coming from the saddle region, while the more volatile materials appears to be erupting from the older, rougher-looking lobe areas. They speculate this volatile material is carrying chunks of water ice that hasn't fully ablated. It's then raining back onto the saddle region, resurfacing it. Eventually, this water melts and evaporates from the saddle, making the area look unusually smooth. Astronomer Dr. Jonty Horner from the University of New South Wales says it's a fascinating paper, and the data appears to indicate Hartley 2 may be a relatively new comet.
Essentially, Hartley 2 is quite different to the other comets that have had flybys, which is really exciting. It's significantly more active. It's quite small, but rather than just having jets coming out from an occasional location and producing a bit of water, a bit of carbon dioxide, it's actually very, very active from the entire surface, much more so than the other comets that have been surveyed. And it's also got much more what we call volatile material boiling away from it in its activity.
Is that because of the carbon dioxide inside it?
It is, which is something of a surprise. These comets are moving on orbits around the sun that bring them in at perihelion to about the orbit of the Earth in the case of Comet Hartley. So when it's its closest to the sun, it's about the same distance from the sun we are. And at the furthest from the sun at the minute, they're out near Jupiter. Now, if you're moving on that orbit for a very long time, every time you're near the sun, every time you're at perihelion, the volatile material at the surface boils off. And this is why you get the coma and the tail that you see with the comet when you're observing a bright one in the sky. And so you can imagine that over time, as time goes on, the volatiles can become depleted. You run out of water and carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, and the comet will become much less active because there's only a few pockets on the surface where fresh material is exposed. What I think is really exciting from my point of view is that if we just look at the comets and try to work out their orbits, we have no real idea of whether they're a new comet to the solar system, so they've spent a lot of their life in the distant reservoirs where these comets come from and have only recently come in, or whether they've been on that orbit for a much longer period of time, and they're actually quite depleted, quite old, and they're not the pristine thing that we would hope to see. What's interesting here is that, for me, these results may indicate that this is a very new comet, that it was captured by Jupiter to the Jupiter family very recently, and it became a short-period comet recently, having been held in cold storage since the solar system formed. And the evidence for that, I think, is all of this volatile material. We know that the water ice boils off when you come down, maybe inside the orbit of Mars, that's warm enough for the water ice to evaporate. But carbon dioxide will evaporate from the surface from ice to become gas at much, much colder temperatures. So it will be losing carbon dioxide for much longer in the orbit, and you'd expect it to very quickly become depleted in these other volatiles. And so the fact it's still so active and still has so much carbon dioxide suggests it's not being around for very long. And that would be really interesting, because it would suggest that this is a fairly pristine object, and we're seeing something much more like the comet was when it formed, rather than something that's been modified for thousands of years.
That's Dr. Jonty Horner from the University of New South Wales. A massive gamma-ray burst that's lasted over 2 months already and is still shining may well be the final death rays of a distant sun being shredded by a black hole. Scientists are astounded by the discovery because gamma-ray bursts usually only last a matter of seconds, a few days at most, meaning what's being witnessed now by astronomers may well be a once-in-a-million-year event. Reporting in the journal Science, astronomers led by researcher Joshua Bloom from the University of California, Berkeley, first detected the blast, which has been catalogued as SW1644+57, on March the 28th, using NASA's Swift spacecraft, which searches the universe hunting for gamma-ray bursts. The supermassive black hole causing the raucous is located in the constellation Draco the Dragon, about 4 billion light-years away. Or to put that another way, 38.62 trillion kilometres. It was a black hole that was dormant until a star about the size of our Sun ventured too close. Most galaxies, including our own Milky Way, are thought to harbour supermassive black holes at their centres. In this case, astronomers believe the black hole's gravitational pull was so great, it exerted tidal disruption on the passing star, tearing it apart and releasing powerful gamma-ray jets as the star was crushed and ripped to pieces at the subatomic level, before disappearing beyond the event horizon to fall forever into the black hole's singularity. Astronomers hope to use this amazing observation to help them learn more about the physics of black holes, and about the sort of massive power it takes to destroy a sun. Well, stargazers and astronomers have enjoyed the longest lunar eclipse in more than a decade, as the Earth's shadow covered the moon, turning the lunar surface into a deep reddish bronze. The spectacular sky show was visible across parts of Europe, Africa, Central Asia, and Australia. The 100 minutes of totality was the longest since July 2000. Western Australia was the best place in the country to see the eclipse. Sadly, for stargazers and astronomers in New South Wales, cloud cover brought a lot of disappointment. Astronomer Fred Watson from the Australian Astronomical Observatory was one of those who missed out on seeing the event because of the overcast conditions. He says the moon would have been spectacular for those lucky enough to witness it.
The eclipse started in the small hours of the morning, and by about 20 past five, the moon had completely entered the Earth's shadow, and so it turned to red. And the reason for that is that the light from the sun filters through the Earth's atmosphere and actually falls on the moon's surface, so you get this blood-red effect.
Professor Fred Watson says ash from that erupting volcano in Chile would have had very little impact on the eclipse.
It would put a little bit more dust into the atmosphere, but really it's the whole of the Earth's atmosphere that's causing that redness on the moon, and the volcanic dust's predominantly in the southern hemisphere. It will probably have made very little difference.
The next total lunar eclipse will be on December 10th. There'll be partial solar eclipses on July the 1st and November the 25th. The next total solar eclipse will take place on November the 13th next year, and it will be tracking across northern Australia, as well as New Zealand, the South Pacific, and the southern part of South America. Now, speaking of the Sun, for years scientists have been predicting the Sun will move into solar max next year, the climax of its 11-year solar cycle. But despite last week's huge coronal mass ejection, scientists say a curious calm has descended on the Sun, suggesting quite the opposite may be happening. The Sun could be in for some quiet times ahead. According to three newly released studies, experts believe the familiar sunspot solar cycle activity may be shutting down, heading towards a pattern of inactivity unseen since the 17th century. The signs include a missing jet stream, fading sunspots, and slower activity near the poles. Scientists say the fact that three different studies are all pointing to the same thing is a powerful indicator that the solar sunspot cycle may be going to hibernation. Normally, solar activity tends to rise and fall every 11 years or so. The solar minimum and solar maximum each mark about half the interval of magnetic pole reversal on the Sun, which happens every 22 years. Understanding how the Sun's solar cycle works is important because it causes space weather, the solar flares and coronal mass ejections, which are spewing energy and particles into space from the Sun's surface. If they target the Earth, these particles can disrupt modern technology, including high-frequency communications, electronics onboard spacecraft, and terrestrial power grids. Mind you, they also have one plus, giving us some really spectacular northern and southern lights, the Aurora Borealis and Aurora Australis. And there's also evidence sunspot activity could be linked to climatic change. Scientists are now probing whether this period of inactivity could mean a second Maunder minimum, a 70-year period when hardly any sunspots were observed between 1645 and 1715, a period known as the Little Ice Age, a time when global temperatures dropped and even London's Thames River froze over. If the scientific data is correct, this could be the last solar maximum seen for several decades. However, scientists warn any temperature change associated with a reduction in sunspot activity would likely be fairly minimal, and it certainly wouldn't be enough to offset the impact of greenhouse gases on global warming. Put simply, they say a new Maunder-type solar activity minimum cannot offset the global warming caused by human greenhouse gas emissions, which are expected to increase global temperatures by between 3.7 and 4.5 degrees Celsius by the turn of the century. In comparison, any Maunder minimum type solar activity would cause a decrease in temperature by just 0.1 degrees. Mercury's origins may be different from its sister planets, including the Earth. According to new findings from NASA's Messenger spacecraft, which show surprisingly rich sulfur deposits on the planet's surface. Early findings from the first spacecraft to orbit Mercury is forcing scientists to rethink how the planet closest to the Sun formed and what's happened to it over the past 4.6 billion years. Messenger is now 3 months into a planned year-long mission. It's already uncovered evidence of a lopsided magnetic field and regular bursts of electrons jetting out through the magnetosphere. Volcanoes appear to have played a major role in shaping Mercury, providing fresh material to fill its cratered surface, and also possibly providing an unexpected supply of sulfur to the surface. A finding that suggests Mercury may have had different building blocks from that of Venus, Earth, or Mars. See, the thing is, scientists expected that Mercury, which is believed to have formed in the hottest, densest part of the original solar nebula, wouldn't have had the right sort of temperatures to hang on to lighter weight materials like sulfur. Elements like that are usually lost in space. But the fact that scientists are seeing sulfur on the surface, and lots of it, means there must have been heaps of sulfur gas coming up from underground. Messenger's new images reveal a massive plain of ancient lava flows, the largest of which spans over 400 million square kilometres, about half the size of Australia. Another surprise was the planet's lopsided magnetic field, which is stronger in the north than the south. Scientists can't yet account for this asymmetry, but one theory is that the planet's magnetic field may be in the process of flipping. As we said earlier, that's something we see on the Sun every 22 years, and it happens on the Earth roughly every 200,000 years. In fact, we're overdue for the next. Mercury is the only terrestrial body beside the Earth that has a strong magnetic field. One of the primary goals of the Messenger mission is to figure out how Mercury was assembled in the first place. we know it has a massive iron core. And scientists believe Mercury's core, like the Earth's, is responsible for generating its magnetic field. MESSENGER's also monitoring regular outbursts of electrons in Mercury's magnetosphere. Hints of this phenomenon were first detected by NASA's Mariner 10 probe when it flew past Mercury back in 1974. Still to come are measurements to reveal if Mercury hides any ice inside its permanently shadowed craters. Scientists at Imperial College London have made the most accurate measurement yet of the shape of the electron, finding that it's almost perfectly spherical. The experiment, reported in the journal Nature, spanned more than a decade. Researchers have concluded the electron differs from being perfectly round by less than 0.000000000000000000001 centimeters. Or to put that another way, it means that if the electron was magnified to the size of the whole solar system, it would still appear spherical to within the width of a human hair. Physicists from Imperial College's Centre for Cold Matter studied the electron inside molecules of ytterbium fluoride. Using precision lasers, they made careful measurements of the motion of these electrons. If the electrons weren't perfectly round, then like an unbalanced spinning top, their motion would exhibit a distinctive wobble, distorting the overall shape of the molecule. But there was absolutely no sign of any such wobble. The results are important in the study of antimatter. The electron is one of the basic building blocks of matter. It has a negative charge. Its antimatter counterpart, the positron, has a positive charge. So understanding the shape of the electron will help scientists understand how the positron behaves, and therefore how matter and antimatter might differ. Currently, the accepted laws of physics tells us that in the Big Bang of creation 13.7 billion years ago, just as much antimatter as ordinary matter was made. We know that matter and antimatter annihilate when they come into contact with each other. So how come we live in a universe full of matter? And how come there is still some antimatter around at all? Since the idea of antimatter was first envisaged by Nobel Prize-winning scientist Paul Dirac in 1928, it's only ever been found in minute amounts in sources such as cosmic rays, some radioactive substances, and believe it or not, bananas. The new research now being undertaken could help explain how most of the antimatter disappeared from the universe, leaving only ordinary matter around. Emotions are running high at the US space agency NASA as workers are being laid off and the last space shuttle is readied for launch. American prestige is taking a bruising. The beautiful winged shuttles are being consigned to museums, some say far too early, and there's just no obvious replacement down the track, at least not in the next few years. The commander of the last flight warns until Congress identifies the next big space mission, it'll be difficult to keep Americans interested. Space Shuttle Commander Chris Ferguson is speaking with the ABC's Craig McMurtry.
NASA is pulling out all the stops one last time. And a 50-year-old Philadelphia native finds himself, unexpectedly, thrust in the spotlight. Astronaut Chris Ferguson was on standby in case a rescue was needed for the Endeavour mission. Now he finds himself stepping into history, commanding America's last space shuttle flight.
I'd like to think that we were all picked as the last crew. We really weren't. There were actually several last crews, and we just happened to be lucky and fortunate enough to be in the position we're in right now.
Speaking to the ABC from the Johnson Space Center at Houston, he says it's a surprisingly emotional time. Many of the 13,000 NASA workers and contractors in Florida are being laid off. Countless shuttle simulators will soon be museum pieces.
Somebody back of the envelope calculation figured out that we probably did about 200,000 practice shuttle approaches out there at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico, and yesterday was the very last one. So there's a lot of milestones, a lot of training facilities that'll be relegated to museums after we're through with them.
At the Kennedy launch site, a giant payload canister is positioned before being loaded onto Atlantis. It's the orbiter's 33rd flight and Commander Ferguson's third, with a massive crowd expected along the Florida Space Coast for the final liftoff. Scrupulous procedures are being followed one last time. Technicians are checking on a possible small leak in the shuttle's external fuel tank, but Chris Ferguson says it's unlikely to cause a delay.
There was a minor leak, I think. I don't know much more beyond that, but beside the tanking test, the processing has all looked very good. We're tracking very well towards a July 8th launch.
He's surprisingly blunt about the uncertainty over NASA's future and the lack of congressional funding and a plan for a new deep space rocket.
That's probably the most disconcerting aspect of all this, that we have made such an abrupt change, and that we have, we had the shuttle, and now we really have nothing.
Chris Ferguson says without a clear path, it'll be hard to inspire people and maintain interest in future missions, possibly to an asteroid, back to the moon, or even Mars. But he isn't leaving NASA and is still hopeful.
You know, there's a new global order, and we're sure the United States space program is going to be a part of it. It's just a question of how large a part.
Gear down and locked.
Right now, he has bigger problems, completing a successful last resupply mission.
I'd have to say probably the highlight will be that last final wheel stop call when the shuttle has finally stopped rolling on the runway for the last time.
And coming up with just the right words to mark the moment.
Drag chute deployed.
I've got some ideas, and like I said, the true challenge is going to be to capture, you know, the hopes, dreams, and the history of 30 years in just a short line or two. It'll be practically impossible. We'll do the best job we can, though.
Forward gear touchdown.
And say goodbye.
NASA Space Shuttle Commander Chris Ferguson speaking with the ABC's Craig McMurtry. Iranian television has announced the successful launch of the Islamic Republic's second domestically built satellite. The Arabic language Al Alam television claims the satellite, called Rashad 1 or Observation 1, was placed into a 260-kilometre high orbit using an Iranian Shafar missile. Back in February 2009, Iran launched its first domestically built satellite called the Omid or Hope. Western experts say Iran rarely gives out enough detail for them to determine the extent of its technological advances. But it is known most Iranian technology consists of modified versions of equipment supplied by China and North Korea. The United States and our allies believe Iran's space program is designed to develop a long-range ballistic missile capability to provide a warhead delivery system for Tehran's alleged clandestine nuclear weapons program. The United Nations and most Western countries fear Tehran's nuclear program is designed as a cover to secretly build atomic bombs. That's an allegation strongly rejected by the oil-rich nation, which insists its nuclear program is for peaceful power generation only. And time now on Star Stuff for a look at the rest of the week's science and technology news with a science report. Scientists have uncovered a trio of genes linked to migraines, including one which appears to be exclusive to women. Migraines are an acutely debilitating headache, sometimes with an aura in which patients have the impression of seeing through frosted glass. They strike up to 20% of the population. Researchers describe the condition, which is 3 to 4 times more common in women, as a brain disorder in which neurons or brain cells respond abnormally to stimuli. The precise cause remains unknown, but genetics is thought to play a significant role. Now, a report in the journal Nature involving a study of the genomes of 23,230 women have found variations in three genes that showed up more frequently among migraine patients. Two of them, known as PRDM16 and TRPM8, were specific to migraines, and TRPM8 was specifically linked to migraines in women. The third suspect gene is LRP1. It's involved in sensing the external world and in chemical pathways inside the brain. Scientists say the influence of these genes is probably not large enough to be immediately used as a diagnostic tool. But the result's nevertheless an advancement in the understanding of migraine biology. New figures show the number of Australian kids with type 1 diabetes is high by international standards. A report by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare ranks Aussie kids seventh highest among OECD nations. Associate Professor Myra Craig from the University of New South Wales says the figures show almost 6,000 children under the age of 14 had the disease in 2008.
Well, we're in one of the top 10 countries for type 1 diabetes. It is much more common in Caucasian populations than in Asia, and viruses, possibly early feeding practices such as formula feeding, also, you know, influence the rate of diabetes. Our rates aren't as high as some of the countries in Scandinavia where the rates are about three times ours, which is reassuring. It's always good to remind the general public, though, of the fact that type 1 diabetes is common.
A new American study warns that boys who were bullies at school are far more likely to abuse their partners in later life. The research by the Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine is based on a survey of 1,500 men aged 18 to 35, of which one in six admitted physically or sexually abusing their partner in the past year. The study found 38% of those who committed abuse were also bullies at school. Scientists say after taking into account other risk factors for domestic violence, such as being abused as a child or witnessing abuse between parents, carrying out frequent bullying as a child was linked to a fourfold increase in a man's risk for partner abuse. A new study by an expert panel of scientists says the oceans are in a worse state now than previously suspected, and marine species are facing an unprecedented threat of extinction. The panel, convened by the International Program on the State of the Ocean, has found that overfishing, pollution and climate change are all acting together in ways not previously recognised. The changes include melting of the Arctic sea ice and the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, an increase in sea level and the release of methane trapped in the seabed. Coral reef specialist Overhol Gulberg says the rate of change is far more rapid than anticipated.
The rate of change is vastly exceeding what we were expecting even a couple of years ago. So if you looked at almost everything, whether it was fisheries in temperate zones or coral reefs or Arctic sea ice, all of this is undergoing changes, but at a much faster rate than we had thought.
Meanwhile, a scientific study in Britain's found the effects of carbon emissions on the world's oceans may be turning fish deaf, drastically affecting their chances of survival. Scientists at Bristol University found pumping carbon dioxide into a tank of seawater to make it more acidic affected the hearing of clownfish. Dr. Steve Simpson, who's involved in the study, says an extraordinary acceleration of the acid conditions in the ocean will lead to a very rapid loss of hearing in fish.
The rate of change that we're experiencing is almost unprecedented. So it's 100 times faster than any time in the last 20 million years. It's a very rapid change in the chemistry of the ocean. So that means in this century, we're talking for clownfish of only a few tens of generations.
Tests are underway to determine the success or otherwise of a fish left on the Shoalhaven River near Nowra, 160 kilometres south of Sydney. The ABC's Nick McLaren reports.
The Sydney Catchment Authority says a $26 million fish lift over the Tallawa Dam is already improving the ecology of the river by allowing migrating fish to move upstream. Spokesman Ian Tanner says they're studying endangered fish populations such as the grayling to determine the long-term benefits.
It's early days with the fish, but we're finding migratory fish in the hopper that is travelling up over the top of the dam and down into the lake behind the dam.
The lift began working in August 2009, but is only now fully operational after being shut down due to faults. Nick McLaren, ABC News, Wollongong.
Paleontologists have discovered the first ever fossil remains in Australia of a giant theropod dinosaur called a Spinosaurus. The discovery means the massive 17-metre-long two-legged fish eater, which dwarfed both Tyrannosaurus rex and Argentina's Gigantosaurus, must have roamed over most of the planet during the early Cretaceous period 105 million years ago. Spinosauroid fossils had previously been found in Europe, Africa and South America. The new Australian discovery, consisting of a 4-centimetre neck vertebrae, was found at Dinosaur Cove near Cape Otway in Victoria. The finding also supports the idea of an Africa-first theory for Gondwanan fragmentation, as a comparison of dinosaur faunas show greater diversity between Australia and Africa than South America. And for more news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. And if you missed it on radio, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news and spectacular images and heaps of other media we couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word and in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.